Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Women's World Cup begins tomorrow in Germany. Ahead in Only a Game, a preview, including the U.S. team's chances to bring back some of that 1999 glory. Also avoiding cacti and rattlers in Arizona's premier one-hole high desert golf tournament. And the life of numbers king, Negro League team owner and scout, Alex Pompez. Also ahead, the ways in which high-tech replay and review technology have changed the sports viewing experience.
It's a distraction. I mean, it's a toy. Did you ever walk in drunk to a McDonald's at 3 in the morning and look at the overhead menu and everything starts swimming around as all this information and you don't know a number 5 and a 6 for $2.99? It's like that.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The sixth edition of the Women's World Cup gets underway tomorrow in Berlin, where host Germany will face Canada, and in Sinsheim, where Nigeria will face France. The U.S. team, led by striker Abby Wambach, will open against North Korea in Dresden on Tuesday. Joining me now to discuss the event is Roger Bennett of ESPN. Roger, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, it takes a World Cup for you and I to speak. It's great to be back.
Germany won the Cup in 2003. They repeated in 2007 as defending champions. I wonder if they even need the home field advantage, which, of course, they have. Do you consider Germany the favorite?
Well, USA, our beloved USA, are actually the number one ranked team in the world. But the bookies favor the Germans. They are the home team. They steamrolled through the 2007 World Cup where they didn't even concede a single goal. And if they get in their groove and the crowd get behind them, they are going to be very, very difficult to stop. The German three-peat seems very, very likely.
The U.S., of course, is the only other team to have won the Cup twice, and they are the defending Olympic champions. But in the run-up to this tournament, they've been inconsistent. So do you like their chances?
Now, the U.S. team, they are a superpower. But in the run-up to this World Cup, Bill, they've been playing absolutely unsyncopated, and they seem almost mentally fragile. So there's a few more lovely soccer teams in sports. I've spent a bunch of time with the team in the run-up to this tournament. They've stepped off to Germany, and they're barely on the media radar. So they really want to play on the field as if they're going to turn that round and grab America's attention, because a professional league in this country is in a fragile state. And this is almost not just an international competition, but a last chance to make America care again about women's soccer as they did in 1999.
You have written about the English team, which beat the U.S. in a friendly back in April. Kelly Smith is the most celebrated player on that team, but the story really is how much the level of play in the women's game in general has improved in England, isn't it?
Absolutely. In England, when I was growing up, women who played the game, they were laughed at. They were scorned. It was a marginal enterprise. That's changed. If you compare them to the English men's team, who are very hard to cheer for, they're loutish. If they're not caught in a prostitution scandal, they're being caught in very public divorces or wrangling for a new contract at a frighteningly high dollar level. This English team, they're all about the game. They're absolutely charming. And they're a rare commodity in sports, an English national team that you can root for without compromising your values.
Brazil is ranked third in the world, and their most illustrious player, Marta, has been considered the best female player in the world for several years. Does Brazil's success depend utterly on Marta's performance?
Marta is an unbelievable sporting specimen. She's probably the greatest women football player ever to take the field. But as you know, Bill, one person doesn't make a team. The question is, who's going to play with Marta? Because one person a winning team cannot make. We're not going to know how good they are till they're a couple of games in. And this Brazilian team has had a glass jaw in finals. They've come second in virtually every major tournament over the past couple of years. And this is really seen as Marta's chance to add the one cup that she longs for to the mantelpiece.
Perhaps the most surprising entry in the draw is the team from Equatorial Guinea. They're ranked number 62 in the world by FIFA, and they encountered some controversy during the qualifying. The Nigerians claimed as many as three of the players for Equatorial Guinea were men. Any fallout left from that charge?
This is the team, the Nigerians, who become weakened because their coach has banned all lesbians from the squad. So they are several of their key players down. And they didn't like being trumped by these newcomers, Equatorial Guinea. And they allege that up to three of the women who trumped them are actually men. Nonsense, said the Equatorial Guinea Soccer Federation, but they have last week actually pulled two of the women, two sisters, who were accused, I guess, not of being sisters, but of being brothers from the squad. These women will not be taking the field. In Equatorial Guinea, they will be taking the field stripped of two of their stars.
Roger, I want to discuss another tournament with you for just a moment. Today, the men's teams from the U.S. and Mexico will meet in the Gold Cup final. This has become an intense rivalry. What's the prize they're fighting for beyond the trophy, and who do you suppose will win it?
Well, there's a couple of prizes at stake tonight, Bill. The Gold Cup is a very bizarre tournament. It determines the regional champion of North America, Central America, and the Caribbean, which is hardly the heavyweight division of world soccer. But the winner of the Gold Cup this year, they qualify for a tournament called the Confederations Cup, which is the warm-up where they iron out the kinks before a World Cup. It will be in 2013 in Brazil, which is hosting the 2014 World Cup. And USA and Mexico, I mean, these two teams really do despise each other. Who will win? The United States, they've been bland. They've been occasionally clueless. They've had a lot of possession. They've not converted it into goals. They've really struggled. Mexico are undoubtedly the informed team. They're undoubtedly favored. But the Rose Bowl in Los Angeles is going to be sold out. It's going to be mostly full of Mexican fans. It may feel like a road game for the USA. And if this battle royale doesn't wake up the American team, I don't know what will.
Roger Bennett writes about soccer for ESPN, and he is the author of The World Cup Companion, among many other books. Roger, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill. I intend to watch every game of the Women's World Cup. It's going to be a little bit like Morgan Spurlock supersize me.
On Thursday, federal judge Susan Ilston gave prosecutors at least another 2 months to decide whether Barry Bonds should face another perjury trial. Bonds' attorneys and the aforementioned prosecutors will be back in court on August 26th to wrangle over the slugger's conviction for obstruction and, heaven forfend, perhaps to set yet another court date. While the government has been trying to prove cases against Bonds, Roger Clemens, and Lance Armstrong, some less famous athletes have been in the courts to clear their names. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Last weekend, Rams linebacker David Vibora flew his dad to St. Louis for Father's Day and soon had something even better to celebrate. A federal judge ruled that a Florida supplement maker called Anti-Steroid Program LLC had intentionally misrepresented a spray that Vibora had used and which had caused him to test positive for the steroid methyl testosterone under the NFL's anti-doping policy. He served a 4-game suspension without pay and lost out on endorsement opportunities. But Vibora says the test cost him something much more valuable.
Well, I've had to go through 2 years of being labeled as something that I was not, and now getting the vindication for that. It goes deeper than just myself and my career and all the hard work that I've put in. It goes into, you know, my name, my family's name, the name that my kids will have, and the pride that they'll have to say that, hey, my dad did it the right way.
U.S. District Court Judge Rodney W. Sippel awarded the largest judgment of its kind, $5.4 million, $2 million for damages to Vibora's reputation alone. Armed with the judge's ruling, Vibora intends to petition the NFL to wipe the test from his record and restore his lost wages. But will his legal team ever be able to collect on that $5.4 million?
That's a great question. The million-dollar question, perhaps. You know, the money doesn't matter. In the grand scheme of things, it truly does not. I mean, when I hired my legal team, I told them that if you're in this for a grand paycheck, then you're in it for the wrong thing, because vindication is what's number one, most important for me.
Vibora's story isn't as unusual as you might think. In February, the Washington Post poured through the case files of 250 athletes sanctioned by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency since 2000. Half of those cases were described as misfortunate, recreational, or, like Vibora's, unwitting. As the head of the UCLA Olympic Analytical Lab for 25 years, it was Dr. Don Catlin's job to catch the cheaters. But he has great compassion for athletes who are caught up in the supplement industry's deception. And he says there's no easy way to know how many supplements, vitamins, and other over-the-counter products are tainted with ingredients not on their label.
No, we have no idea. I mean, there are thousands of supplements, so many of them, and they come and they go. It's a terrible problem, but all you can do is to try to develop a program so that they can get answers for their particular supplement.
Vibora thought he did everything he could to research the supplement he used. He checked the label, asked teammates who were using the same product, and even called the NFL's anti-doping hotline to make sure he wasn't missing anything. Now, he says, he has all of his supplements tested just to make sure they don't contain anything they shouldn't.
I mean, it's just worth it to have the peace of mind that what you're putting in your body is in fact clean.
None of this would have helped the WNBA's Diana Taurasi, who was suspended by her Turkish basketball team after a late December positive test.
Diana Taurasi has yet to score tonight. Missing again from the outside. She is 0 for 3. All three of those shots have come from outside the arc.
On Tuesday, Taurasi had a rare off night playing for the Phoenix Mercury. She's back on the court and her record has been wiped clean after a lab in Turkey admitted to serious errors and declared that her positive test result was, in fact, negative. Vibora and Taurasi were both represented by attorney Howard Jacobs, an anti-doping case specialist who has also represented sprinter Marion Jones and cyclist Floyd Landis. Jacobs says he does his best to restore the reputations of his clients, but it's not always easy.
Yeah, the problem is, in using Diana's case as an example, when that first happens, of course, there's a whole flurry of news stories. And so everybody reading about Diana Taurasi will see that story. But who knows, you know, 2-3 years from now, if somebody Googles Diana Taurasi, which story is going to come up first? Is it going to be the positive test or is it going to be the vindication?
Meanwhile, this summer, another high-profile doping drama will play out. 1 week from today, Alberto Contador will begin his bid for a fourth Tour de France title. During his 2010 winning ride, Contador tested positive for clenbuterol in concentrations small enough that he was able to convince the Spanish Federation that he had unknowingly ingested it in tainted meat. That ruling is being appealed by cycling's governing body and the World Anti-Doping Agency. But until the case is resolved, Contador is free to race and perhaps win again before it is even fully determined whether his 2010 title will stand. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The life of a Roman gladiator was doubtless hard, and in the case of one Diodorus of Amisus, bad officiating made it harder. An 1,800-year-old tombstone commemorating Diodorus was recently translated, and it reads as follows: "After breaking my opponent, Demetrius, I did not kill him immediately. Fate and the cunning treachery of the Sumerudus killed me." Summa Rudis was the referee when gladiators battled, and the reasoning of Michael Carter, who translated that tombstone, is that the Summa Rudis on this particular occasion erroneously allowed the fallen Demetrius to pick up his sword and keep fighting. If the commissioner of gladiatorial combat responded to the alleged treachery, the record has crumbled to dust. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the life of Alex Pompez, Negro League team owner, scout, and numbers king. But first, the proliferation of sports replay and review technology has brought more sports information than ever to viewers. As Only a Game's Doug Trabue reports, there's even more minutia to come.
For the past decade or so, Major League Baseball telecasts have included replays of pitches with the strike zone superimposed. But this year, for the first time, ESPN is putting the box over the catcher during some at-bats while they're being shown live. SportVision created K-Zone and supplies similar technology to other television networks. SportVision president and COO Mike Jacob says how often K-Zone appears during live action is ESPN's editorial decision.
Experimenting going on, trying to figure out what's the optimal mix. But for a particular at-bat where you're expecting a kind of a pitcher-batter duel, it is interesting to see how the pitcher's working that batter over the course of the at-bat.
New York Post sports columnist Phil Mushnick says with the score, pitch speed, players' names, stats, and sports news already on the screen, he can do without another visual.
It's a distraction. I mean, it's a toy. Did you ever walk in drunk to a McDonald's at 3 in the morning and look at the overhead menu and everything starts swimming around as all this information and you don't know a number 5 and a 6 for $2.99? It's like that.
K-Zone may be partly television window dressing, but the technology behind it is data-driven. SportVision has tracked every major league pitch since 2007. Using three cameras, they calculate the trajectory 50 times between the pitcher's hand and home plate and adjust the strike zone for each batter. The company claims it's accurate to within an inch, and the league and its teams are more than willing to pay for that kind of data.
I love the human element. I don't know that umpires really should be a part of that.
That's SB Nation's national baseball editor Rob Nyer, one of the moderators at this spring's MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston. Nyer says reviewing balls and strikes would be too time-consuming, but expanding replay is long overdue.
Look, my favorite team won a World Series because an umpire made a lousy call, the 1985 Royals. If I could go back and change that, would I? You know, I might. The Cardinals fans have a legitimate gripe. They probably should have won that game and the World Series if the call had been made correctly. Baseball would be better, I think, if that had not happened.
Today, baseball is using replay for close-call home runs and is reportedly considering a plan to allow umpires to review fair and foul ball calls and trapped ball catches in 2012. The NHL has reviewed goals for years. The NBA reviews three-pointers and buzzer beaters. Mike Pereira spent 9 years as the National Football League's vice president of officiating and now works as a rules analyst for Fox Sports. He believes review has improved the quality of NFL games.
And I so vividly remember a Thanksgiving Day game in Detroit where there were three on-field officiating errors that got corrected by replay. And the beauty of it was is that the next day in the paper, there was no mention about the fact that replay had corrected these errors or that the errors were made in the first place. The topic of conversation was about the football game and the players.
One of the most prominent sports video technologies is football's yellow first down line. It's also produced by SportVision and is so popular the company is working with NFL teams to include it in highlights shown in stadiums. Pereira likes the yellow line, but hopes it stays limited to televisions and jumbotrons.
You know, there are people that are out there with technology proposing a first down line as you can see on television and be able to put it actually on the field, projected on the field itself. The poor official now who has to make a spot and comes in and puts the ball down 1/16th of an inch short of this visible first down line is going to be accused of having been involved in a conspiracy.
Sports Illustrated senior writer L. John Wertheim co-authored a book called Scorecasting that analyzes blown calls and other factors that contribute to the outcomes of games. Last summer, Wertheim was in England covering Wimbledon. The tennis tournament uses Hawkeye technology, which involves several cameras and a complex algorithm to calculate whether balls are in or out.
The next day I watched this World Cup game between the UK and Germany, and there's this dispute over whether the UK scored a goal. And they ended up botching the call. It was a goal. It had crossed this line, and the officials thought it hadn't. And I was just marveling at how you have this huge sports property that's resisting technology, and sort of backwards conservative tennis is the head of the field.
However, Wertheim says the improved accuracy in tennis does come at a price.
Tennis had this history of these arguments and seeing players erupt over these botched line calls. John McEnroe is the great exponent. And I think it's a fair point that you've sort of bleached away some color when you've got this video board. I mean, the fans like seeing the replay, but the fans also like seeing these confrontations, and you don't really have too many of those now because you've got the right call with darn near precision.
All this talk about using technology to improve games and broadcasts got me thinking. I asked Sport Vision's Mike Jacob to explain which parts of a game translate to the best graphics for fans at home.
It has to be something that happens a lot, is hard to see, and has a meaningful impact on the outcome of the game.
Let's see. Something that happens a lot, is hard to see, and has a meaningful impact. That sounds like Bill's weekly conversation with Charlie Pierce. Maybe only a game should have its own audio reminder for listeners.
Charlie Pierce is coming up in 15 minutes and 10 seconds.
Perfect. Anyway, in sports, there's more technology coming.
Charlie Pierce is coming up in 15 minutes and 6 seconds.
Okay. Our technology's probably not quite ready for prime time, but the next level of data gathering is already beginning in baseball. Sport Vision's Mike Jacob says his company's goal is a complete digital record of every game.
Knowing where every player is at every point in time, multiple times a second, as well as the referee and the ball.
In case you missed that, here's a low-tech instant replay.
Knowing where every player is at every point in time, multiple times a second, as well as the referee and the ball.
And Jacob says that kind of tracking will generate a lot of data.
Think of a steal play. We'll know how far the runner got off first base before the pitcher went into his motion. We'll know how far he advanced during the motion. We'll know, you know, how long did it take the catcher to get the ball out of the glove. How far did the shortstop have to run and how fast to get to second base. You know, what was the top speed of the run? I mean, there's just so much data that you can collect on every play.
SB Nation's Rob Nyer has a prediction about how all of this information will change things for fans at home.
Someday we're going to be able to sit in the middle of a room and have the field, the players be around us, 3D or whatever you want to call it. But there's no reason why with miniaturization of cameras and chips and all the other stuff, you couldn't do all of those things.
And while people like Scorecasting co-author John Wertheim are ready and waiting for the next deluge of sports information, he respects fans who already feel oversaturated.
There's definitely a segment that says, look, enough already. I don't need to know Derek Jeter's percentage on balls hit behind the pitcher's back on a rainy night in the Pacific time zone.
But if it happens to come up in conversation, someday soon you'll be able to find out. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
Alex Pompez, who became an exceptional judge of baseball talent and a very good fellow to know if you were trying to stock your major league ball club with Hispanic players, began his career in baseball in 1916 as the owner of the Cuban Stars, later the New York Cubans. He was also a very successful businessman and one of the few businesses open to black entrepreneurs early in the 20th century. He was a numbers king in Harlem. In that capacity, he got muscled around by notorious gangster Dutch Schultz. No wonder Adrian Burgos Jr. felt the life of Alex Pompez would make a good book. Adrian Burgos joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be back.
Shortly after 1910, Alex Pompez became a powerful force in Harlem as a so-called numbers king. Explain what that meant.
A numbers king was one of those group of numbers bankers that ran the illegal lottery. Today's version is called the Pick Three. And he was a banker. And these bankers employed collectors, and he was at the very top of that. And not only was he at the top of his own numbers bank, he was also one of the biggest numbers banks in Harlem. In 1932, his numbers bank gross revenue was between $5 and $7 million. According to his own testimony, Tom Dewey, special prosecutor later in New York City, said he thought it was more like $10 to $15 million that it was grossing.
I guess it wouldn't be accurate to say that all the owners of Negro League teams built their fortunes the same way.
But most did, particularly in the Negro National League. The numbers provided ready capital, and the way numbers kings were viewed was totally dependent upon, did they recycle that money into the community, or did they just line their pockets with that money? And guys like Gus Greenlee, Abe Manley, Rufus Sunnyman Jackson, and Alex Bumpez were all viewed as good community men, as race men, because they recirculated that money within Pittsburgh, New York, and Newark. And that's what colored people's perception of Alex Bumpez. The New York papers would call him a square dealer. He was a square shooter. He was a stand-up guy because he would constantly remain tied to his New York Harlem roots.
And when you say recirculated, in this case, it means these guys were lending money to entrepreneurs and businessmen in places like Harlem, guys who could never have gotten loans from establishment banks.
Exactly. You know, help them start up restaurants, local concerns, you know, cigar stores, candy stores. It just so happened at times that these plays doubled as a center for numbers collecting. But, you know, that's so much the better for keeping the industry going.
Once famed gangster Dutch Schultz decided that he wanted to take over the numbers business in Harlem, I guess it was a good thing Mr. Bumpez was able to go full-time into the baseball business.
Right, because, and again, this is an indication of how good he was at evaluating talent, that he was able to survive in a just a baseball context after Schultz came in, took over the Harlem numbers racket. Then he's killed, and Bumpez was forced to flee to Mexico, arrested ultimately. And we had this great scene where after testifying at the Hines trial of 1938, Bumpez says, I'm going strictly into baseball. There's a lot more profit in the numbers, but it's much more troubles. And as I write in the book, you know, Bumpez and reemerging him and recasting himself as strictly a baseball guy, he didn't have to worry about his competitors trying to bump him off if he was too successful. And yeah, baseball is a lot safer.
In their best years, the New York Cubans beat the most established Negro League teams. Luis Lefty Tiant, father of Major League standout Louis Tiant Jr., led the Stars to a Negro League World Championship back in 1947. Was that success the result of Bumpez's ability as a scout?
I believe so. That 1947 club that featured a young Orestes Minoso before he became many when in the major leagues, and other talented players like Silvio Garcia, almost retired Horacio Rabbit Martinez, and Lorenzo Chiquitin Cabrera, and Claro Duane, very big names in Latino baseball. He had to convince them to come north to play for his team. And that team in 1947 would have the really fascinating misfortune of winning the Negro League World Series in the year that Jackie Robinson, just across town, was integrating the major leagues. So that really was indicative of what Alex Bumpez and others had to deal with in 1947 as Negro League entrepreneurs.
The Negro Leagues were essentially done in by integration, the integration of the major leagues in 47, although not quite immediately. How did Alex Bumpez make the transition from team owner to scout for Horace Stoneham, who owned the New York Giants?
In 1944, Stoneham and Bumpez agreed for the New York Cubans to rent out the Polo Grounds when the Giants were away. After Robinson was signed, Stoneham and his scouting director, the Hall of Famer Carl Hubbell, decided, why don't we tap him on the shoulder and get some advice? And what Bumpez did was advise him that in 47, they began to sign guys like Monty Irving. Hank Thompson would be signed in the winter of 47 into 48. And these guys would be the initial black players. Well, let me give you an indication of how important Alex Bumpez is to this process. The Birmingham Black Barons made one trip to New York City in 1948 to play at the Polo Grounds. Alex Bumpez talked to his friends at the New York Amsterdam News and the New York Age and convinced them not to mention the star center fielder for the Black Barons, Willie Mays, in their coverage and not to print any box scores. And that inside touch within that world of black baseball is what the Giants tapped into when they hired Alex Pompez to be their man.
I'm speaking with Adrian Burgos Jr., the author of Cuban Star, and you're listening to Only a Game. You quote Felipe Alou, the former Major League player and manager, as saying of Pompez that, quote, anywhere and everywhere they played baseball, Panama, Colombia, Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Pompez was a legend. Was Mr. Alou exaggerating?
I don't think so. He would bring players out of Panama in 1921 into the Negro Leagues. He would sign the first Dominican that played in the Negro Leagues in 1926. In 1928, he would sign the first Puerto Rican to play in the Negro Leagues. And then when he became a Giant Scout, he once again would traverse these circuits and bring in talent. And with his former shortstop, Horacio Martinez, they would open the Dominican talent pipeline into the major leagues by signing the players that we know so well, Marichal, the Alou brothers, Manny Mota, and others out of the DR. And they were the ones that later on guys like Pedro Martinez himself would look up to as heroes. You know, it's Marichal. You know, that's the guy they look towards. And Alou is clearly one of the elder statesmen of the game, and not just the DR, but in all of Latin America for the stances he took throughout his career and after.
The final chapter of Cuban Star suggests that the story of Alex Pompez can be instructive to all of us living in the U.S. today, no matter what our backgrounds. What should we learn from the narrative of his life?
One of the aspects is his is an immigrant tale. He's the son of immigrants, but it shows what the first generation of U.S.-born Latinos have to navigate in this world. For him, it was about being black and Latino and being bilingual and seeing those not as a deficit, but to build on those, to make pathways into opportunity. So you have a guy who had a multicultural background who used it to improve the national game because he signed guys like Willie McCovey and Willie Kirkland, as well as guys like Cepeda and Alou and others. And in a certain sense, Alex Pompez was a 21st century figure. He was kind of ahead of his time.
Adrian Burgos Jr. is the author of Cuban Star, How One Negro League Owner Changed the Face of Baseball. It's published by Hill & Wang. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Adrian, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been wonderful to be back here.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
If you don't want to run into any naked people, stop right here. So read the signs around the nude hiking trail recently established in Wuppertal, Germany, or beautiful Wuppertal, as the mayor of the town likes to call her domain. How beautiful the trail in Wuppertal is on a particular day perhaps depends on who's hiking, but the concept of the nude trail also appeals to some number of litigants in Switzerland, where the right to wander, tromp, or skip through the Edelweiss in the altogether will soon be taken up by the Supreme Court, all the members of which will likely be wearing clothes, even if it's a really nice day and they decide to convene outdoors. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the dreadful downhill lies of mountain golf in Arizona. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
All right, the NBA draft has come and gone. Upsides and wingspans were discussed in detail, and monosyllabic European names were, for the most part, particularly pronounced. Did any of Thursday's picks or trades catch you off guard?
Not particularly. I still think Jimmer Fredette being as drafted as high as he did and eventually winding up with the Sacramento Kings is going to come back to bite them. I don't see him as a substantial NBA contributor. I think it was interesting that the Morris twins from Kansas, Markeith and Marcus, who were born 7 minutes apart, were drafted almost exactly 7 minutes apart.
And not by the same team.
And not by the same team, exactly.
This week, NBA owners offered, quote, flex cap to the players who apparently have remained inflexible, at least as the owners see it. The current agreement expires on Thursday, so time to worry about the 2011-2012 season yet?
I think this is going to be a lot uglier than the NFL for the simple fact that I think the NBA management side is far more unified behind the leadership of David Stern than the NFL ownership is behind the leadership of Roger Goodell. I think the NBA season next year is in tremendous trouble right now.
Last year, Ross Perot Jr., who owns 5% of the Dallas Mavericks, sued Mavericks majority owner Mark Cuban, claiming that he was, quote, reckless and careless. How'd you like the brief Mr. Cuban's attorney filed this week to answer that charge?
Apparently, the 2011 NBA championship was an extended exhibit for the defendant in this lawsuit because they submitted a brief. By the way, the official defendants in this case, the Mark Cuban ownership group, is called Radical Mavericks Management. So that's fairly cool. But they submitted the uncontestable fact that the Dallas Mavericks won the world championship and that, therefore, Mr. Cuban is a pretty good owner. And they included in their evidence a picture of them holding up the Larry O'Brien trophy.
That's my favorite part. When it came time to hire a new manager, the Florida Marlins opted to go with experience. Did they make the right choice?
Yes, they dug up Connie Mack. No, they didn't dig up Connie Mack. They brought in octogenarian Jack McKeon, who, for what I believe is a publicity stunt. He's there because there's no reason to watch the Florida Marlins anymore, and he already picked a fight with his best player, and that got him a lot of really great publicity, but anybody who thinks he's running a team day-to-day is out of their minds.
The Washington Nationals are one of the hottest teams in baseball, temporarily at least.
What?
But that apparently was not enough for the team to grant manager Jim Riggleman's request for the team to pick up his contract option for next season. So he quit after his team won on Thursday. And I guess it's good to go out a winner.
Yeah, he said, give me an actual contract, make me the manager, get rid of the name, get rid of the word interim ahead of my job title, or I'm not getting on the plane for the road trip. The Nationals said, we're not going to do that. He said, fine, and didn't get on the plane.
Yeah, the players
you can't
flew
fire
off
me.
On
I,
their own.
You can't fire me. I quit.
Charlie, since last we spoke, Rory McIlroy made up for his failure to master the Masters by opening up an enormous lead at the U.S. Open and holding on to that lead through 72 holes. He won the tournament by 8 shots on Sunday. Should Tiger Woods even bother to return to the tour?
Well, I think Tiger Woods is going to come back. I think he's a little bit more likely to come back now than he was before Rory McIlroy turned congressional inside out. He's not going to play again until the British Open. McIlroy, that is not going to play again until the British Open, which I find a little bit curious. I thought he might want to strike while the iron is hot, pick up some more publicity, and further advance his image right now. But apparently he's going to take it easy.
Aircraft carriers are very big. Is that reason enough to hold an NCAA basketball game on one?
That's funny because the sainted Al McGuire, former coach of Marquette University, used to call big men aircraft carriers. He used to say, I need to go get an aircraft carrier. Well, the NCAA has gotten an aircraft carrier on Veterans Day on November 11th, formerly Armistice Day, I might add. The USS Carl Vinson is apparently going to host on its upper flight deck a game between Michigan State and North Carolina. I have one advice for the players. Don't go quite so hard for loose balls out of bounds.
When he was 18 years old, Marius Rovda, who's a goalie with the Vancouver Whitecaps, thought about getting a great big one tattooed on his back, traditional goalie's number, but he worried that if he got that tattoo, he would regret it when he was 30. So?
He got it when he was 30. He thought about it. He meditated on it. He contemplated it. He gave it a mature, he took a mature approach to it and had the number one painted on himself anyway.
People who remember one of Germany's contributions to the Men's World Cup back in 2010 won't be surprised to learn how the Sea Life Aquarium in Sinsheim, Germany, is preparing for the 2011 Women's World Cup, right?
They are auditioning replacements for Paul the Psychic Octopus. who was the hit of the 2010 World Cup in terms of predicting Germany's matches. There are octopi from all over Germany flocking to this aquarium with a chance to do a part in the new German reality show, So You Think You're a Psychic Octopus.
The idea of octopi flocking is just irresistible.
They're hitching down the Autobahn. It's really an amazing scene. They have eight legs. They're hitching. They get lots of rides.
How come you didn't say sports when I asked you that
because
question?
That's legitimate sports.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry. We'll get to it.
Congratulations to Jenny Finn.
Sports!
Who has pitched the U.S. softball team to many victories in the Olympics
and
elsewhere.
But that's not what we're talking
no,
about.
No, it's not, because she and her husband, former major leaguer Casey Daigle, celebrated the birth of their second son this week, and his name is...
Diesel Dean Daigle.
Diesel Dean. And finally, Charlie, perhaps not wishing to be outdone by little Diesel Dean Daigle, Ron Artest has filed a petition in court to change his name. And what does he want to change it to?
He wants to call himself Meta World Peace. That's M-E-T-T-A, middle name World, as spelling, as in World Be Free.
World Be Free.
You'll remember from back in the day, Lloyd Free of the Philadelphia 76ers changed his name to World Be Free, and last name Peace, P-E-A-C-E. I understand the World Peace thing. The Meta with two T's, not a clue. Not a clue, unless he's been watching History's Mysteries again and saw something about the Assyrians.
Well, I'm sure we'll get some answers from listeners via email.
Because Meta thing is M-E-T-A, so I don't know what he's doing here. I'm telling you, it's History's Mysteries.
Charlie Pierce, a veritable diesel of world peace, among other things, is the author of Idiot America, among other books. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Billy, Billy, Bo, Illy, Bo, Nana, Panna, Bo, Billy, Pee, Pie, Mo, Millie. Billy, very good. Now let's do Marsha. Marsha, Marsha, Bo, Basha, Bo, Nana, Panna, Bo, Basha, Pee, Pie, Mo, Asha. Marsha. A little trick with Nick. Nick, Nick, Bo, Big, Bo, Nana, Panna, Bo, Big, Pee, Pie, Mo, Mick.
Yesterday, it became apparent that the NHL team moving from Atlanta to Winnipeg will be known as the Jets when they get there. The NHL team that played in Winnipeg from 1979 until 1996 was also known as the Jets. In Atlanta, the team was the Thrashers. Now in Winnipeg, they'll revive the name Jets. Hooray, say fans of history and tradition, but that was not the consensus evident yesterday afternoon in the Only a Game office. They blew a great opportunity, said Doug Trabu. They could have been the Thrasher Jets. That would have been cool, I said, or they could have been the Jet Thrashers. You mean Jet Thrashers, like thrashing the Jets as they fly by, like the Transformers, Gary asked? Yeah, I said, Jet Thrashers, or Jet Thrashing Transformers, Doug suggested thoughtfully. Perhaps in another office that might have been the end of the conversation, because where do you go after Jet Thrashing Transformers? But then somebody remembered the story we'd run when Memphis got their NBA team, and we found these guys at a bus stop in Memphis who were talking about what that team should be called. One of them said, how about the Dogs? And the other one said, yeah, or the Crazed Dogs. Yeah, the first guy nodded, the Memphis Crazed Dogs. And so that's what Memphis has always been to us, and the team entering Winnipeg will be the Jet Thrashing Transformers. And now you know why Only a Game is just an excellent place to work. Think of golf hazards, and three things usually come to mind. Water hazards, such as lakes and rivers. Man-made hazards, such as bunkers and sand traps. And vegetation. 2 weeks ago, the El Fuego Baca shootout took place in Socorro, New Mexico, and as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, this long-running championship gives new meaning to the term golf hazard.
With its tree-lined campus alongside a PGA-approved golf course and a sprawling driving range, New Mexico Tech University extends like a green oasis into the inhospitable high desert. But soon, golf balls will be ricocheting across the rugged mountain, standing in the distance, as the El Fuego Baca Shoot, a one-hole, six-hour, three-mile-long golfing ordeal, tees off for the 51st straight year. The eight entrants from New Mexico, Arizona, and California will have to juggle golfing, mountaineering, and survival skills as they work their way down almost 3,000 feet of cactus-strewn Socorro Peak. Then they'll trek for miles more through the rocks and mesquite bushes at the mountain's base until they land their final shots in a 30-foot-wide circle on the edge of campus.
Okay. So your pencils, your scorecard, and your balls are all marked. Okay.
Early on this hot Saturday morning, they pick up their allotment of 10 balls, stamped with personal identification numbers. They step outside to hear final instructions and caveats. It's a little different than what the competitors would hear at Pebble Beach or St. Andrews.
You've heard stories about what can be up there? This is going to be perfect season for rattlesnakes. We want you to leave them alone. You know, we even had a story like, you know, where we had a mountain lion up there. Has anybody ever seen a mountain lion before?
Russell Moore, the golf director for the New Mexico Tech course, adds that the local flora and fauna, which also includes swarms of biting gnats, aren't the only challenges awaiting these extreme golfers.
We have a saying for those of us that have been associated with the tournament is that, you know, we don't have any water hazards, but we have enough hazards to make up for that. It's very easy to step on what you think is solid footing, and a rock will slip, and all of a sudden you're taking a tumble.
There are no golf carts in the El Fago Baca Chute, just a 15-minute off-road ride up 7,200-foot-high Socorro Peak. Instead of golf shoes, participants wear climbing boots. After a 15-minute hike to the top of the mountain, they tee off from a small wooden platform protruding into space.
And with an 8:35 tee time, the defending champion from Socorro, New Mexico, Dennis Walsh.
A well-struck ball can travel 800 yards before reaching the plateau almost 1,000 feet below. That's the easy part, says Dennis Walsh, a golfer with a handicap of 1 back on Earth.
Well, it's not like strolling down a hill. You're coming at an angle 42 degrees.
Sure.
Yeah, down slippery shale. And it doesn't get a whole lot easier the rest of the way down until you get to the flats. Then you've got another, oh, I don't know, it's 6 or 7 shots after it's, you know, 95, 96 degrees out, and your legs are tired from coming off this harsh angle for 2.5 hours. And it's a different kind of walk than I've ever done in my life.
With golfers strung along the mountain, there's no waiting for others to take turns. You can move the ball as far as 50 feet to a better lie, so long as it gets no closer to the hole. And you can tee up every shot, another concession to the unpredictable terrain. The preferred method uses a sawed-off broom head laid as flat as possible on the ground with the tee wedged between its bristles.
Okay, here you go. See, he's going to whack it this thing. Coming at us. A little shy of the 450.
Each golfer also brings along 3 spotters, usually recruited friends or relatives who communicate with two-way radios as they scramble to locate each shot amidst the mountain rubble and desert scrub. Since every lost ball results in a penalty stroke, and losing all 10 earns a disqualification, fielding a crack team of spotters can spell the difference between victory and defeat.
Whereabouts, Primo? Right in that first little canyon right there.
Mike Stanley, who claimed the last of his record 17 El Fago Baca crowns in 2002, says he won several without losing a ball.
You've got to be able to position your spotters to where you want to hit the ball. And then the best of all worlds is to hit one of your spotters so you can find the ball real easy.
Right there is going to be the spot. If I move that rock.
New Mexico native Jesse Thomas spent a decade as a spotter before picking up the clubs himself. Nearly halfway through the course, he clobbers a 450-yard drive, thanks to the still-sloping landscape. As he plants a tee in his broomhead for the next shot, he sizes up his chances.
It's been rough. I lost 2 balls, and I think I'm not going to be in the money today.
Thomas is headed for a score in the low 20s, about par for this course. Most El Fago Baca golfers carry just a driver and a short iron that they'll save for their final shot. When inverted, the clubs become serviceable walking sticks. But to El Fago Baca legend Mike Stanley, the most essential piece of equipment is an item not normally found in golf bags.
You know, you talk about experiences and memories, and most of them deal with cactus. You know, people slipping in cactus and falling in them, and you better take tweezers with you and be ready to pull some cactus spines out of you. I think if I'm ever in an autopsy, they'll find lots of cactus in my legs from the El Fago. Yep.
As the bands of spotters fan out across the remaining mile and a half of flatter terrain, they look like farm workers engaged in some insane harvest. This year, that harvest is good to reigning champ Dennis Walsh. Barely 5 hours after teeing off, he completes his round with a neat 30-yard wedge shot into the red circle. He cards a 15, 7 strokes ahead of the closest challenger, for his third championship, and sums up what it takes to succeed here.
You have to really love the game, and you have to love the mountain. You know, the mountain is its own beast.
Some reverence for history may be in order as well. The original Alfago Baca shootout dates to 1884, when a new sheriff by that name took on a band of cowboys terrorizing Socorro. His descendant, Gilbert Eugene Baca, says the real trouble began after Alfago arrested a drunken cowboy.
He took cover in a nearby jacal, or mud hut, and by that time there was over 80 cowboys came over there and were trying to get him out of that hut. Of course, they were trying to kill him, you know. But he held them off for 36 hours, and they counted over 4,000 bullets that were fired into there. But that's the main story of his fame, you know.
To hear the golfers tell it, the fame of the Alfago Baca shoot lives up to its Wild West heritage. And who knows, maybe over the past half century, more than 4,000 golf balls have gone missing in the hostile New Mexican desert. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Alfago was calm and his aim, it was true. He'd ride with the law till the battle was through. With a star on his chest, he was law in the West. They called him Alfago El Gato.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view pictures of the Alfago Baca shootout, the ones of the golf tournament, not the fabled 1884 confrontation, or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from an interloper during the 2011 Alfago Baca shootout.
We are the champions!
Whoa! How'd that fearsome creature escape confinement in Dallas? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
In the land of big men, when this great West was wild, Alfago was small and his nature was mild. And the legend was that, like Elgato the cat, 9 lives had Alfago Elgato. He dared to stand up to the toughest of men. He faced all their 6 guns again.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.